As you were just told, I'm an astrophysicist. And what is that? That means that in buildings labeled theoretical physics on the front, I'm an astronomer. All right? And that means I'm a little bit different than some of the other speakers you've heard today in that images are not a way for me to just conceptually understand the ideas that I'm trying to talk about and trying to probe. And it's not a way for me just to present results, but they're, in fact, the way I go about trying to probe the universe. They're an integral part of the scientific process for me in trying to access data on the universe. Okay, so today, what I was going to try to tell you about was how we do this, how we make images, how interesting physics is encoded in those images, how producing images is crucial to visualizing the important results that we produce, okay, and in fact, even what's important in those images when we do this, right? Some idea of, you know, what aspects of an image matter and what maybe matter less. Okay, so the title of my talk is Portrait of a Black Hole, and that might sound a little glib, but I mean that literally, because we are now at a point in history where we can start taking images of black holes which resolve their event horizons. Images that look kind of like this. All right? So here's a bunch of collaborators. If you really want to know about other people to talk to, come talk to me after the talk, and I'll put you on the right track. All right, so what does a black hole look like? And the answer is it looks like a black hole. And that's probably not terribly surprising. So what do we mean by that? Imagine we have an infinitely bright external universe, bright everywhere around. Okay, so maybe something like the cosmic microwave background, but brighter. All right, what does a black hole look like against that? I don't care what it is. It could be your grandmother's wallpaper, but it's just some bright thing out far away. Okay, and it really does just look like a silhouette. And the reason is quite simple to understand. Photon trajectories that don't pass too close to the black hole, only very weakly lensed. All right, they come from infinity, which was bright. Grandma's wallpaper far away. They come to us. They make a bright spot over here. That's something like this spot on this picture. Okay. But as we get closer and closer to trajectories that would go straight down or start straight down the center of the black hole, they're getting more and more strongly lensed until at some point we have trajectories that are orbiting the black hole many times, okay, before starting on their horizon and making their way towards us. All right. So a photon which would have ended up, if we're over here, would have ended up at this point on our screen, would have had to have begun on the horizon and come to us. And of course, the horizon's black. It's not emitting. And so we don't get any light. All right? So it really does look like a silhouette. It's not cast a silhouette. It's not blocking light behind it. Okay? It's because these photons would have had to have started on the horizon. All right. The size of the silhouette is just the size of the region that defines the photons that began on the horizon. And because of gravitational lensing, it's typically bigger than the 2 gm over c squared that people talk about for Schwarzschild black holes. All right. Now, in practice, we don't have this bright, uniform universe. We don't have grandma's wallpaper behind the black hole to look at. And so that makes it somewhat technologically challenging to take pictures of them. But black holes are the brightest objects in the universe. And the reason why they're the brightest objects in the universe, despite being black holes, is because they're very compact and stuff falls a long, long, long way before finally becoming part of the black hole itself. And as it falls a long way down, it's just like dropping a penny off the top of the CN Tower. It accelerates in the normal way all the way down. And all of that extra kinetic energy becomes thermalized as it jostles and bumps into all the other stuff that's falling on. It heats up and shines. And that's how black holes are the brightest objects in the universe. They're the most compact objects, and so they produce the hottest accretion flows. And so we're really talking about imaging this surrounding, orbiting, luminous plasma around the black hole. All right? However, we still get an image that looks kind of like what I showed you a moment ago. You see this black silhouette. Of course, it gets dark as we get far away from the black hole again. And we still have the same characteristic scales. Okay? Photon trajectories that would have begun near the horizon tend to be darker. Photon trajectories that were a little bit further away, but still pass through bright parts of the accretion flow, are much brighter. And we see the influence of the black hole then on these images in the form of their silhouettes. And so this is what I'm talking about imaging. This is what we're taking pictures of. So why hasn't this been done before? I mean, it just sounds like an obvious thing, right? If you want to know about black holes, go take a picture. No kidding. The main problem is that black holes, despite their enormous mass, are actually very, very small. Okay, so here's my two-scale reproduction of the inner solar system. The distances are two-scale, the planets obviously are not. All right, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, inner solar system. And if I were to take the 4 million solar mass black hole at the center of the Milky Way and put it where the sun is, two-scale, this is its size. All right, it's well within the orbit of Mercury, 4 million solar masses. And that might sound big. It's certainly bigger than the sun, certainly bigger than the planets. But remember that this isn't nearby. This is 24,000 light years away at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. All right, so that means that in angular terms, it's tiny. Okay, 55 microarc seconds. Okay, a microarc second is a millionth of an arc second, which is a 60th of an arc minute, which is a 60th of a degree. All right, picoradians. All right, if that doesn't help, it's the size of the poppy seed on my bagel on the CN Tower viewed from Vancouver. Right. So these are really, really small. And this is the technological challenge that people have been overcoming now that makes this possible. All right. They have to contend with one important and incontrovertible limit due to something called diffraction. Many of you may have heard of this, especially photographers. But if you haven't, don't worry. You're intimately familiar with it. All right. Let's make it kind of stable. My laser pointer is actually a pretty good circle. How many people see a circle? And how many people see a star? Yeah, I see a star too. Okay? That star is because of diffraction through your pupil. Anytime that light, which for our purposes right now is a wave, passes through a finite aperture, it makes a star pattern or it makes a diffraction pattern. It gets bent around just by the process of going through that finite aperture. Okay, and the reason why it looks like a star to you is because your pupil isn't exactly round. It has little asymmetries in it, and that produces a star pattern. And the next time you're in a passenger seat in the car at night, please don't do it while you're driving, pay attention to the other headlights or the street lights, and you'll see that they'll all look like stars too. And in fact, if you close one eye, they'll all look like exactly the same star. Okay? And what you're doing is measuring the shape of your pupil via diffraction. And even cameramen see this. Okay, you see the diffraction spikes on images of streetlights when they take long exposure pictures. All right? So how does this affect astronomy? Well, if you take the kind of telescope I have, this is an 8-inch Newtonian reflector. I'd like to take it out back with my daughters and look at planets and stuff. And you would ask, what would a star look like? An actual point source. The answer is it doesn't look like a point source. It looks like some funny spread out pattern. All right. And the central peak, I'm sorry, there's one equation. The central peak has a width that goes as the ratio of the wavelength to the aperture size, the size of my telescope. Shorter wavelengths and larger telescopes make smaller patterns, give me higher resolution. Smears out the image less. Right. So for my telescope, this size is about 600,000 microarc seconds. Okay, so I'm not viewing black holes from my backyard. But there are bigger telescopes. There's Keck, 10 meters. The VLT is 8 meters. Gemini is also 8 meters. There are a lot of really big pieces of glass in the universe on the planet these days. And they are all actually diffraction limited once they take care of atmospheric fluctuations with fancy adaptive optic systems. And you can see this in these two pictures of a stellar field, in fact, from the galactic center. Galactic center is right there, right about there in both images. And you see in the VLT, which has nice circular mirrors, these nice circular diffraction patterns, just like the one I showed you before. For Keck, they're hexagonal because Keck's mirror is also hexagonal. All right? So it really is diffraction limited. But even with 10-meter telescopes that are 50 times the size of the one I have in my backyard, we're still talking about 20,000 microarc seconds. Okay? So 1,000 times too low a resolution. Even if we talk about the overwhelmingly large and ridiculously expensive class of telescopes that they're talking about building, 100-meter telescopes, we're still talking about 2,000 microarc seconds. All right. So this isn't something you do in the optical or the infrared. You just can't do it. We don't know how to build a telescope big enough. It would have to be kilometers across. That's an enormous mirror. We don't know how to do that. All right. But there is a telescope that can do this now, the Event Horizon Telescope. And the first thing about it is it works at a millimeter. And that sounds like it's going in exactly the wrong direction. At a millimeter, you need something that's not a kilometer across. You need something that's 10,000 kilometers across. All right. And we don't know how to build a 2-kilometer mirror, but apparently people do know how to build a Earth-sized radio telescope. And the way you do it is by taking individual radio telescopes across the Earth and putting them together. Many, many millimeter and submillimeter telescopes, and consists of existing and planned observatories, so we don't have to spend enormous sums of money. All right. And at the end of the day, this gets us down to 10 microarcseconds. How does that work? Well, how many of you have a smartphone? So when I joined PI, because PI was founded by a gift from the owner of RIM, we all got BlackBerries. I was very excited about that because I haven't had a smartphone before. And one of the first things I do with it is I check where I am on the bus on the way to PI. All right, so I'm busy checking out using GPS. All right, and GPS, you know, here's our lone backpacker on the mountain, wants to know where he is. He's lost. He pulls out his GPS device. He gets a timing signal from multiple satellites. Does a little timing calculation. Okay, he knows how much longer this path length is to this path length, and if he knows where the satellites are, he can triangulate his position. All right, the way that the Event Horizon Telescope works is very similar, except backwards. All right, we have now, instead of one hiker, we have two telescopes on the ground. We have a source way up here. That source emits a burst of radio waves. And as these radio waves propagate down, unless it's exactly above the two telescopes, at zenith, if it's at some angle, it gets to one of these telescopes before it gets to the other. And so if you carefully measure the time delay between them, you can measure the angle. Now, in practice, that's actually quite difficult. But if you have an extended source, you get different time delays from each point along the source. And you can measure the differential time delays with extraordinary accuracy, picosecond accuracy. Okay? And that allows you to measure angular structure on the source, still at this diffraction limit, lambda over d. But now d isn't the size of the individual telescopes, it's the distance between them. All right, that's the leverage you get from putting them far apart. The time differences are large. All right? And so if we put these things Earth distances apart, either side of the globe, we have effectively an Earth-sized telescope. All right. Now there's a catch. That sounds too good to be true, and it is. And the catch is that we don't actually measure an image. We want to make a nice, pretty picture like this, okay? But we don't actually get one of those. What you measure are these things called visibilities. There's a well-defined procedure to go from visibilities to an image and back. Okay, you can go back and forth between the two. In practice, every pair of telescopes gives you one pixel in this visibility image. And so the name of the game is to measure the visibility. There's a whole bunch of places in this picture here. Construct an estimate for what the visibilities are everywhere, and then do this fancy transform to get back what the image looks like. So that's the plan.
If you have a visibility, why do you even want an image?
Well, in practice, we do all of our analysis in the visibility plane. Firstly, I have a visceral response to this, and not as much a visceral response to that. But no, for the science, you're right, and I'm going to show you a little bit of what we can do already with this. Okay, so we have many telescopes already. Three of them are operating together. There's already data. We already are measuring these visibilities in those three telescopes. There are many additional sites that are planned, that already exist, that are already planned to be added to the array, and potential additional sites that could be added. In fact, we already have one of these ALMA prototype dishes now. Okay, so those are telescopes that we would have to put in. So what could we do with these? Well, if this was what it really looked like on the sky, with seven of them, we could make a picture that looks kind of like this. And that looks pretty terrible. But the first thing you notice is it's about the right size. All right, already this would be the highest resolution image ever made in astronomy. All right, with eight telescopes, it's starting to look more and more like the crescent, 9 even more, 10, 11, 12, 13. It looks pretty good. All right, we're really talking about an imaging instrument. We're really talking about being able to make these kinds of pictures and really do make these extraordinarily high-resolution images. All right, so the first conclusion, the Event Horizon Telescope is going to allow us to make the highest-resolution images in the history of astronomy. And we're going to be able to use that to look at black holes. So what do we expect to see? Well, the first thing I want to show you is a movie of an orbiting hotspot. All right, so I apologize for the contrast here, but we have an orbiting hotspot that's zipping around a black hole. All right, if you get confused at what we're looking at, there's a little diagram up here that shows an unlensed version. The inclination is changing. The viewing angle is changing with time to give you an idea of how that affects the image. It doesn't actually change in practice, okay? And it will just repeat. So the first thing you'll notice is the presence of a secondary image, right? We have one image, and then we got another image. It recedes a little bit. Okay, that's strong lensing. That's light being bent around the black hole and producing multiple images of the original hotspot. And I'll show you some pictures of how that bending happens. The second thing you might notice is that when it's coming towards us, it's bright, and when it's going away from us, it gets dim. And towards us, it's bright again, and going away, it's dim again. All right? So that's kinematics. It's Doppler beaming, Doppler boosting. Special relativistic things coming towards you look brighter. When they're receding from you, they look dimmer. So knowing something about how bright it is over here and dim over there gives us information about the kinematics of this spot. The next thing you might notice is that the spot has some finite size, right? And that gives you an image that kind of smears the image out a bit, an image of a characteristic size. All right. So that's a hot spot. And here's a picture of where we get these multiple images from. Here's just one snapshot from that movie, one frame of the movie. This blue region up here, this big spot up here, comes from photons that come almost directly to us from the black hole. They pass right over the top of the black hole and come to us, one shot, okay? But there's this other little region down here in the image, it's now green, and that comes from photons that were emitted in the wrong direction. Okay, but the black hole helped shepherd them along and they got to us. They ran around the back of the black hole and got to us. Those rays spend more time near the black hole are more affected by whatever the black hole is doing, but whatever strong gravity is doing. There's even a tertiary image which you can barely see. It's probably not going to be terribly scientifically useful right now, but I'm just happy when I can tell that they're there in the pictures. And those are caused by photons that go all the way around. Okay, there's a whole infinite sequence of these, but we start getting very, very dim. All right, so it's really the primary and the secondary that matter. And because these spend different amounts of time near the black hole, are affected to different extents by what's going on near the black hole, we get different amounts of information about strong gravity from these different aspects of the image. All right? We can use one to calibrate the rest, and encoded in those images then, the comparison between the primary and secondary, is information about the space-time right near the horizon. Now that was for spots. And in practice, we don't think that Sagittarius A star is going to be dominated by spots all the time. If ever. We think that it has some sort of big accretion flow. When you think of accretion flow, I think modern television makes us think of accretion disks, like a plate. For something like Sagittarius A star, we're not talking about a plate, we're talking about a donut. Something very much thicker, looks something like this. And we can go ahead and make pictures of that. You can imagine just adding a bunch of those spots up. Okay, we end up with one quiescent image. And this is what you saw in the front of my talk. It's one of these pictures. Okay. And then, like I said, this depends upon the gravity of the black hole. It depends on what the black hole is doing. If the black hole is sitting there, not rotating, we get a picture that looks something like this. If it's rotating very, very rapidly, that changes it dramatically as it drags photons around. And in fact, it doesn't just depend upon what the black hole is doing. It also depends upon, like I said, the dynamical features of the accretion flow. If here's our zeroth order model, our standard quiescent disk model in a general relativistic background, this is what it might look like if it were more dinner plate-ish, a thinner disk, and therefore a cooler disk. Or if it was very sub-Keplerian, if it's not orbiting as fast as we think it should. All right. And so you can easily tell just by eye the distinction between those images. But even better, and maybe sexier, and more appropriate for a place like PI, is we can start breaking not only the accretion theory, not only astrophysics, we can start breaking general relativity. And we can ask, well, if these images are sensitive to strong gravity, what's going on near the horizon, can I somehow test whether or not strong gravity is really described by general relativity? And the answer is, again, that makes a difference, yes. Here's our zeroth order GR case, and we make our black hole a little bit more like a cigar. You can tell the difference. If you make it a little bit more like a plate, again, you can tell the difference. And these now may not look terribly different. I mean, they're not that striking. But the reason why they look so close is it turns out that these are the ones that we can already distinguish. And I'm going to show you a picture of that in a moment. All right? But the main message here is that encoded in these kinds of images, the reason why we want to take these images is important gastrophysics. All right? What's the dynamical state of the disk? How thick is the disk? How hot is the disk? How do black holes accrete matter and grow? But also, and even more exciting, potential insights into how strong gravity works. Is Einstein right? All right. So that's all exciting in the future. I showed you what we could do with 13 telescopes. We don't have 13 telescopes right now. We have 3. So what can we do? We would like to measure the visibilities, Fourier transform, get the measured images. We can't do that. We have data at these white points. All right. And if I gave you a photo with only the white pixels filled in, you probably wouldn't think we could say very much. So in practice, we go the other way. We simulate an image. We apply a prior on what we think is a reasonable accretion flow. And we plug that in, compute the visibilities, and compare. All right? And when we do that, we end up with a probability distribution for a multidimensional parameter space. And this is kind of the output product from this. So we're sitting here with our radio telescopes looking at Sagittarius Star. It's got some spin direction and some orbital angular momentum direction for the disk. And that has a magnitude, how fast it's spinning, and it has an angular orientation. Right, so an angle relative to the line of sight, but also an angle on the sky, an orientation on the sky. Okay? So there's 3 numbers that describe the spin of the black hole. And after we fit everything else we know about for Sagittarius Star, made sure that we can fit all of its other properties, we go off and try to measure this spin now with that first set of data from the Event Horizon Telescope. And we end up with a probability distribution in this spin magnitude, inclination, and each panel shows a slice. It's sort of a vivisected probability distribution, a different position angle. All right? And so this is another way that imaging is important to us. We need to be able to visualize these high-dimensional parameter spaces because we're not at a stage yet where we're just at one little point. You can tell that we have this very long correlated extended probability distribution. So if I were to tell you that the inclination is 68 plus or minus 20 degrees or something. Okay? That's not really honest. Okay? That's from here to here. And maybe the inclination alone is 68 plus or minus 20 degrees, but it's highly correlated with the spin magnitude as well. All right? The width of this little pencil beam is certainly not 20 degrees. So we actually know it quite well. So to honestly report our results, imaging plays an important role, producing images. In fact, I spend most of my time figuring out how to present these kinds of things. Now, I showed you those pictures of what Sagittarius Star might look like, what the black hole center of our galaxy might look like if GR were wrong. Now we've added another parameter. We have the spin direction, the spin magnitude, but now we also have how broken GR might be. Okay, so now it's not just visualizing a three-dimensional parameter space, which in principle I could do with glasses and I could go fiddle with on my computer or something. 4D parameter spaces are even worse. And again, we have exactly the same issue. We're constrained to live in this kind of narrow region now, and visualizing and presenting that is difficult. The exciting news about it is that our best fit models are not GR. GR is still okay, but they're not GR. Okay? And these are the models that are half as likely as the most likely model, and those were the ones that I showed you before. All right? So, my third conclusion is that visualizing these kinds of results in these high-dimensional parameter spaces, even for this, where 4 isn't that high, is becoming a challenge, and we need new ways to try to produce those representations to understand just what we've really learned. Now, I've talked a little bit about fitting these visibilities, and I've talked a little bit about these visibilities, but I didn't mention that they're not real numbers. They're complex numbers. And that's important, because we've all been fitting only real numbers. And what have we been fitting? If you remember from high school physics, or high school math, maybe introductory college math, complex numbers have a real and imaginary component, and you can represent them that way, or you can represent them in a polar coordinate, a magnitude, and an angle. All right? It turns out that magnitude you can measure fairly well now. It's not easy, it's easier to measure. That phase is very hard to measure. That's what the atmosphere mucks up. That's why you need to do adaptive optics with optical telescopes. The atmosphere is busily messing up the phases of your waves. All right. However, we really would like to get that information. And to illustrate that, I'm going to use some local sports teams. All right, so if some aliens watch the Stanley Cup in the future, wanted to tell us who was going to win this year, and they painted these on the sky, and we made a mistake, and we measured the visibility magnitudes for the Canadians, but the visibility phases for the Leafs, and put them together, we end up with an image that looks like this. Go Leafs. Obviously, the aliens don't know anything about hockey. So, and this just illustrates the point that this phase information is much more important in determining the structure of the image. Okay, prove that we could reverse the two, and now you get the Canadians. Most images are noise. An image might be worth 1,000 words, but most of it's white noise. How many of you save your pictures of GIFs or JPEGs? Right? And the reason why that works, the reason why those are so much smaller than a bitmap, is because most of the photo is noise. And you just throw away the noise, you're left with the important part, and that's all you have to remember, and that's why a GIF can be so much smaller. And this is just a representation of that fact. All right? So it turns out what we're measuring isn't really the best thing to measure. However, we are now able, it is now possible to start getting at these phases. All right? First measurement was made that last year. And that's only going to get better. And so just to illustrate how important those are, here's a picture. Now, this is a marginalized probability distribution. What I mean is I've integrated over that orientation on the sky. All right? You don't really have to worry too much about the details, except for the fact that this is the distribution we have right now. All right? This is the probability distribution for the spin magnitude of the black hole at the center of the galaxy versus the inclination of the direction of the spin. Okay? This is what it looks like if we add the current phase measurements, which are fairly weak. This is if we improve them to plus or minus 5 degrees. This is if we get them down to the anticipated precision on a number of triangles. Okay, and this is if we add in one more very important array. All right, and you can tell, oh, and this is if we add in two more dishes. All right, one in Chile, one in Mexico now. And there it is. That's the allowed region now. That's how well we'll be able to measure the spin and the inclination. Now, I would say the systematic errors on that are probably pretty high. Okay, but the addition of that phase information will dramatically improve what we can say. All right? And the same is true for looking at whether or not Einstein's wrong by constraining this parameter by which we've broken general relativity. Okay, this is add a few more telescopes, and this is putting in that phase information. Okay, so not all information on images are equal. Okay, the access to the visibility magnitudes is useful and interesting and exciting, but the phases are where the action is at. All right, so here's my summary, and since I'm talking to artists, I thought it would be good to put a visual summary. Event Horizon Telescope is going to take highest resolution images in astronomy. In those images are encoded insights about both astrophysics and fundamental gravitational physics. Visualizing these types of our parameter searches, visualizing the results of our analyses is crucial to understanding and having a faithful representation of what we're learning. And you know what we look at in the images depends sensitively upon what's critical in constraining the structure, and it turns out that the phase information is what we're looking for next. All right, thank you very much, and I'm happy to take all of your questions.
You talked about you use all telescopes on the Earth. Do you use any information that you can get from telescopes that are already out in space?
So there is now, there was a mission by the Japanese many years ago to fly a space-based radio telescope for this purpose. There is now a Russian mission that does this. I think they might be ESO as well, but I'm not sure. And the idea there is exactly what you're describing. You know, lambda over D, you make D really big, you get very high resolution. There are two problems. The first is if I put one telescope out there, I have one baseline. Now, as a telescope orbits, it samples many baselines, but then that's one thin ring. Okay, and you don't fill in the intermediate bits. That's the first. The real problem is that you can't put a millimeter telescope in space. If you go to some of these millimeter telescopes, they're dishes. They're not quite a mirror, but they're good enough to shave in. They have to be really smooth, and they have to be big. They have to be, in order to be sensitive enough, we're talking about things that are 10 meters, 12 meters. And putting a 10 or 12 meter shaving quality mirror in space is not feasible at the present time. And if you don't put a millimeter dish in, all that junk that's shining around the black hole that's so important because it makes it possible for us to see it is opaque. So below a millimeter in Sagittarius star, it's optically thick. And so you'll see this wonderful, bright, glowing, shapeless ball. So there aren't plans right now. What do black holes lead to? You mean, do they evaporate or what? Oh, what's in the middle?
I mean, what happens?
I
mean, a journey into a black hole.
What's don't
that like?
Do it. all right. So for Sagittarius star, you know, the real problem until you hit the singularity. In which case, you're talking to the wrong guy. We can bring Lee back. Maybe he'll talk about that. You need quantum gravity to start talking about what happens at the very center. But that's not your real problem, because you will have difficulties long before that. The real problem is tidal forces. It's right now, I'm standing. My feet are closer to the center of the Earth than my head. My feet are getting pulled a little bit harder than my head by gravity. And if it weren't for the floor pushing me up, I'd feel a slight stretch. All right? It's caused tides on the Earth from the gravitational field from the moon. And the same thing is true near a black hole. If you were falling in feet first, your feet would be being pulled just a little bit harder than your head. You'd be being pulled apart. All right? Near the horizon for one of these supermassive black holes, you probably wouldn't notice. You'd happily pass right on by. You'd notice that your friends would stop returning your emails. But that's really where you'd start to have problems. But then, as you fell deeper and deeper into the black hole, these tidal forces would get stronger and stronger, and at some point would just tear anything that you brought in apart. So that's the bad news. That's the standard story. But in reality, we don't know. And in fact, one of the things that the Event Horizon Telescope has already allowed us to do is start placing important constraints on perhaps a more basic question than what happens when you fall into a black hole. Do black holes exist? That might be surprising to hear someone say that. Black holes are very problematic for a number of reasons. We hear people throw things like information paradox around. Einstein himself didn't like horizons, the idea of things going in and never coming back out. Okay, so you know, there are some biases against whether or not they exist. The best evidence that they existed up until a few years ago was just doing really hard calculations, trying to figure out what else they could be. And you exclude every other possibility, and you say, well, I've excluded everything else, it must be a black hole. But that's really, you know, I'm talking to a bunch of people whose job it is to be creative. And that's really a failure of creativity at some level. Okay, so maybe it could be something else. It's one thing to say, I don't know what else it could be. It's another thing to say, because I don't know what else it could be, it must be a black hole. But recently, because we've been able to get constraints on how big it is, we can start to very, very quantitatively constrain what else it could have been. Okay, and you don't just get it from images. All right, the fact that there's this big black circle in the middle is actually not proof that there's a horizon. Like if I had put a star there, you wouldn't see it, because in the radio, stars are pretty much black. Okay, but the fact that there's a finite size. Okay, and if I have stuff raining on, that stuff radiates when it rains on. If it landed on something that I could see, if there was something other than a horizon, if that stuff didn't disappear from my universe, I should be able to see the emission from that. And you can constrain that now. And so I can tell you that if you want to make it a universe that doesn't have black holes, that you really have to jump through some hoops and change some physics that we think we understand pretty well, physics you can test in the lab. That's an even more basic question than what happens when you fall in.
The number of black holes that you've studied, is it the same ratios that the number that go around, the number that go the wrong way, and the number that loop once?
So those are photons. Those are photons going around one black hole. There are two targets that are, well, there are more than two targets, but there are two targets that we can do a good job resolving the horizon of. The first is the one at the center of our galaxy. That's just because it's so close. 4 million solar masses might sound like a big number, but it turns out that's pretty light for one of these supermassive black holes. The next best target is the one at the center of M87. That's 4 billion solar masses or so now, so maybe 6 billion, so 1,000 times further away, but 1,000 times more massive too. But those pictures were of photons going around each way. And every image will have all of those contributions to it.
Same relative proportion numbers of...
Oh, okay. It will depend upon the details of the black hole spacetime. That's exactly right. And it's, you know, so that's one of the things that strong gravity is encoded in. So if I were to show you a rapidly rotating black hole, so, you know, I have a movie of this. Why don't we just go get it? So, you just give me a moment. Where are you? All right. So you saw that movie of a hotspot. That was a slowly rotating black hole, but this is what it might look like if it were very, very rapidly rotating. So the first thing you notice is that you can maybe kind of notice, the rotation of the black hole winds up the space-time. All right. But the second thing you notice is that the lenses, okay, this crescent is the secondary image, okay, and it's persistent. It's almost always there. It's about equally bright. So that most certainly depends upon the structure of the space-time.
So the phase measurement depends on synchronized local oscillators at the telescopes.
Not synchronized. I mean,
but phase locked local.
They're not phase locked to each other. So all of the analysis is done after the fact. You just have to have a good local oscillator. Right. So this is the job of the correlator, and that's one of the things that makes it technologically challenging, because you do have to find the location of all of your telescopes to within a fraction of a millimeter, and you have to know the timing relative to a fraction of a millimeter second, or a light millimeter, right? Okay. Getting the phase information, the way you do that is with these things called closure phases. And the reason why you need to do something, even if you had phase-locked local oscillators, that still wouldn't be good enough, because the atmosphere is busily distorting the radio waves above each telescope, and it does this in a random, uncorrelated way. And so if you were to actually, now I showed this measuring alpha, you don't actually measure alpha. And in fact, those pictures I was showing, over a night, they can move back and forth by arc seconds. Okay? So I can say very accurately that this is what the picture looks like, but I can't tell you very accurately where it is on the sky because of these phase distortions.
So what's the prospect of an optical long baseline measurement and get an optical picture?
Okay, so there's no prospects right now for doing optical. Well, optical imaging is right out because the galactic center is heavily extincted. Infrared, they're trying. So there are experiments, gravity, appropriately named, at the VLT to phase that up into an infrared interferometer. All right, it's never going to be an imaging experiment. What it's going to do is measure the centroid of the light. It's kind of the center mass of the image, center of light of the image. And it's going to watch it shift back and forth during flares. And it's going to be able to do that with 10, 20 microarc second precision on minute timescales. So that's the plan for gravity. And that is one of these infrared interferometers. Doing one over kilometer baselines, that's very difficult for a lot of reasons. And there are no plans for that right now. So this is the only imaging game in town.
I ask, what frequency are you looking at in your radio telescopes? What regions are you looking at?
So 1 millimeter is 300 gigahertz. So we're looking at 230 and 345 are the two windows that we actually are talking about. I should emphasize, I'm a theorist. I make all the pictures, and I do some of the analysis on the data. And I say data because it's calibrated and already reduced by the time I get it. It has a nice number and an error bar, and that's what I analyze. And I shouldn't ever, and I don't ever want to give the impression that's the same thing as dealing with data, which requires a great deal of suffering to actually analyze, you know, reduce to a point where I could do anything with it. So those are being done by a team, international team, led by Shep Dolman at MIT Haystack. But we write a lot of papers together on this. So.
You mentioned that the best fit you had was not general relativity.
Yes.
I'm just curious whether the parameters of that best fit model have anything else to recommend them. Is there...
Well... You mean if you had a strong prior in favor of general relativity, how much would you have to give it up?
I guess I more mean, is this a model that anybody has used to explain something else?
No.
You know, no.
No, no, no. So this is quasi, well, yes and no. All right. This is quasi Kerr. So this is an important problem in this line of work, and in fact, anything trying to study strong gravity using black holes. And that is, we don't have a good way to break general relativity. I mean, the string theorists will have some ideas of possible things that you might do. Usually, the kinds of things that particle physicists come up with are important for cosmology, so very long distances, but it's really hard to say what they will do right down near the black hole. Okay, so we don't have a good way to break space-times here. And there's no good reason to believe that general relativity has to be right here. Nobody's tested it anywhere near these kinds of systems, near this regime, where it's very, very different than the Newtonian limit. So how do we go breaking GR? We've been using this thing called the quasi-Kerr metric. And the quasi-Kerr metric is it's based on this space-time that's appropriate for a slowly rotating neutron star. So the thing about a Kerr black hole is it's very specific. Right, it's defined entirely by its spin and its mass, and everything else is determined. Right? A neutron star can have magnetic fields, it can have internal structure, it can have a different quadrupole moment, and so it has a more general metric, a more general space-time around it. The problem is, if you take that neutron star and you shrink it down to a black hole, it starts to have trouble. Okay, you develop singularities outside the horizon and other bad things. Right? The quasi-Kerr metric is a way to try to extend that down to a black hole. And itself is sick. It has singularities and stuff. And so we just prescribe, you know, some rule to deal with that. We say, let's be conservative and pretend that, you know, it's just quasi-Kerr outside of some surface. And inside of that, we just drop it in, and we don't let you change anything anymore. So all that I have to recommend it is a well-defined way to mess with GR. It has a good physical interpretation far away. That gives you a measure of the quadrupole moment of the black hole. That's wrong. Okay, so you know it's a well-defined procedure, but it certainly doesn't explain anything. But I mean, there's no obvious reason why that's any better or worse than GR for black holes. There are these bumpy black hole expansions. You can go to arbitrarily high multipoles. The one problem with them is, what is a big quadrupole moment? I mean, what's a big dipole moment for something? And it depends a lot on your dynamics. Like, what would be a big quadrupole moment, quadrupole deformation of the Earth? And if I said, I have now ruled out 20% quadrupole moment, or 20% quadrupole deviations in the crust of the Earth, you know, would you be surprised? That wouldn't be very impressive. The Earth doesn't stretch that much, okay? It stretches, but not quite like that. So I don't know how to define big for the multiple expansions. And for this one, for the Hartle-Thorne metric, you know, I have some idea of what big means because I know how deformed a neutron star would have to be to make that. Yeah. That would be fantastic if we could find such a thing. Okay.
Yeah, I have a question. So in your field, are there analysis tools, like you show a lot of plots, you do a lot of data analysis. Mm-hmm. Are there computer tools that don't exist that, you know, you could really benefit from? I mean, you say you have some high dimensional data, but I guess there's software for that. I don't know. Is there something that you'd prefer to visualize your data with? Doesn't exist.
Oh, well, lots. Yeah, I mean, when you're working with new technologies, you end up doing everything the quick and dirty and ultimately painful and slow way. And that's certainly true here. I'm doing this analysis in some standard numerical computation package called MATLAB, which isn't terribly great. But it's not viable after this. So we've got four parameters in the post-analysis fits, and after that it's not viable. So we need to move to something much more sophisticated, and that'll probably involve things that will run on supercomputers. So some sort of Markov chain, Monte Carlo, or some clever minimization routine. But then the visualization stuff, I'm not really aware of too many high-dimensional visualization tools. I mean, I know of things that allow me to visualize three dimensions, and I know of things that allow me to visualize time-dependent three-dimensional things. Okay, so maybe I could do four dimensions that way, but what do I do if I want to look at higher than that? I'm not sure. I'm not even sure schematically how to go about doing that. And so developing that would be really, really useful, I think. Oh, this is called MATLAB. Well, that's what the pictures are drawn in, and that's what the post analysis was done. Producing all of the, that's what these pictures are drawn in. Producing the images, I have a special program that runs on supercomputers and does that. And then making one picture is easy, but to do this kind of analysis, I made millions, and that's not as easy. So, specialized software for that.
Another question. Sorry, did I miss somebody? No.
I just want to ask a couple real quick. One of them is, when do you, in your base case scenario, of having all these observatories link? I mean, what is the time period that, is it 10 years?
Well, so, and I skipped this guy. Well, let's go back to him. Okay, this is in some sense today. Again, this is a little bit thicker than one of the earlier plots I showed because it's averaged over the orientation. All right, this is today, but just to give you an idea of how much better things get. All right, this is what it's going to look like. I'm sorry. This is what it's going to look like in a few years, 2 years. Okay, and the big difference is this guy right here, Alma. So the funny thing is, this whole project, I mean, the pie in the sky cost estimates are like $100 million. That sounds great. And the reason why it's $100 million, I made a mistake of telling some big experiment guy that it was only $100 million. And he pointed out, yes, but Alma costs $1 billion, and someone else built it. So yeah, that's true. it's a very expensive experiment if we had to build it all. Alma's being is this radio array down, millimeter array down in Chile. It's already producing some images. It's just going to be absolutely fantastic. And they've already given the green light to Shep and his colleagues going down and installing their stuff and doing what's necessary to bring it into the Event Horizon Telescope. And that will be completed over the next 2 to 3 years. And so we'll be able to draw pictures like this in the next 2 to 3 years. Okay, so that's the big one. Adding telescopes after that, right now it's not too hard. I mean, people want to be involved in this, especially telescopes that aren't ALMA, because ALMA will do all of the same science that every other millimeter telescope did over their entire lifetime in about a week or two. All right, so they're all looking for a good reason to still exist, and the Event Horizon Telescope's wonderful, because ALMA's great, it's fantastic, can't praise it enough, but it is one station in the Event Horizon Telescope. It's located in Chile, so all these other telescopes get another lease on life. And so we don't really have any real difficulty getting them involved. And of course, all the people involved with those other telescopes have been heavily involved in talking to people about the Event Horizon Telescope, too. There is one, the South Pole Telescope. I mean, that was funny. Those plots, Google Earth was great. You can zoom in on where every telescope is. I can tell exactly where it is. Okay, but the South Pole, you can't see the South Pole on Google Earth. It's a big white spot. And not the right white spot, because you can tell where the real satellite images left. And so I'm sitting here racking my brain. Well, how do I know exactly where the South Pole Telescope is? Duh. Yeah, duh, right, it's at the South Pole. But yes, the South Pole... The South Pole Telescope is something that we can add. There's a proposal already to build the appropriate receiver to add it into the array. Yes, there is a South Pole Telescope. Oh, it's used for cosmology. So for these kinds of measurements, you need to be at high, dry sites. That's where you can see through. I mean, the atmosphere, the big problem for millimeter astronomy, for high-frequency radio astronomy, is water absorption in the atmosphere. So you want to get above as much atmosphere as you can, and you want to be in the driest places possible. And that's why you have to wear an oxygen mask if you want to go work on ALMA. So you don't suffocate. It's high and it's dry, and even better than Chile, in this place where you have to wear an oxygen mask, is Antarctica, which is just extraordinarily dry. So they have a telescope down there. It's hard to get to, but that's someone else's problem.
I'm just wondering, wouldn't it be a heck of a lot cheaper to, instead of spending your collective research money, dollars, whatever, building telescopes, to invest that in developing new ways of visualizing the data?
You have to have data to visualize. And there won't be any data to visualize for something like from something like the EHD until those telescopes are developed and put together. So I agree. I would disagree that just putting money into visualization would be the better or more effective route. Most big observational projects, most big scientific projects, do have a budget for analysis and visualization. I guess
it strikes me
we
that
don't yet.
As you were talking, you meant like that seems to be the limit to or one of the two obstacles, like the actual presence or the existence of telescopes, and then the ways to organize, process, visualize the data. So why would it seem that there's so much emphasis on the one front and not the other?
Firstly, remember I'm talking to artists. Visualizations are important. Okay, so I'm gearing the things that are important for this particular audience. Certainly building the telescopes, or not building them, bringing the telescopes into the array is crucial to improving dramatically the constraints we can place. However, our facility and the ease with which we will be able to analyze the deluge of data will depend upon our ability to visualize and understand what we're looking at. And, you know, this is something that my group will be working on, is trying to come up with better ways to do that. But I'm always happy to hear suggestions, especially for these high-dimensional parameter cases when we have this highly correlated data. And I just don't know if there's any good answer yet. It's not a unique problem for this field, though.
Sorry, another left-field question. So, besides the visual, is there work being done trying to figure out by sound or vibration to map this?
Well, okay, so sounds don't travel so well in the interstellar medium, so there is no direct means of listening for black holes. There's something called reverberation mapping, which isn't sound. Basically, you look for a relationship between activity from the central object and then a reflection activity from a little bit further away. It sounds like sound, but it's not. The one thing that people talk about in relation to sound is gravitational waves. All right, and one of the reasons why people like to talk about that in the context of sound is because the premier gravitational wave observatory, LIGO, operates in a band which is the same as sound waves. Okay, so if you want to analyze or think about LIGO data, one simple way to do it is just to plug it into a speaker and listen. Okay, and they have the Scott Hughes at MIT, you know, brings a speaker to every talk he gives and plays sound waves for emerging black holes, and you hear these nice little chirps and stuff. They're most certainly our plans, and you know, if the direct discovery of gravitational waves is one thing, but LIGO doesn't exist just to find them. It exists to use them to study these objects. And that's absolutely the plan. And if you could get optical or electromagnetic, radio, infrared, optical, X-ray, whatever, some electromagnetic signal and those gravitational waves, that would unlock just an enormous number of possibilities for doing precision cosmology. And so people are most certainly looking at those.
Maybe I can squeeze one more question in. I'm wondering, in non-technical terms, if you could tell me what are the other frontiers of astronomy that excite you? And I'm sort of thinking long term, like in the next 100 years, you know, what amazing things might we discover in 100 years' time?
Well, 100 years is an awful long time. I know what's exciting right now to me, and that's probably an easier question for me to answer. I certainly, these very high-resolution studies, I think, are fascinating. But all, you know, gravitational waves, whole another band of the universe, and that goes also along with any new messenger. Okay, so gravitational waves is one. Another one is these very high-energy gamma rays. Okay, so they are building arrays now that can do surveys at just extraordinary gamma ray energies, 10 TeV or something, all right? And every time, you know, we know every time that you look at the universe in a new band with a new messenger, you see something interesting. Another one might be neutrinos. Okay, neutrino astronomy is an untapped field. You see new things. An excellent example, just bringing it back, is radio. So in radio, we all use this unit called the Jansky. It's this pitifully small unit of flux, 10 to the minus 26 joules per meter squared per second per hertz. It's ridiculously small. Okay, you need to build very sensitive things to do any radio astronomy. And here's Jansky going off building dipole antennas in his backyard. They're just big, long wires stuck together. To the scorn of all of his colleagues, they say, look, let me explain the thermal spectrum to you again. All right? So just to draw that. All right, so. Well. Frequency, okay? And flux, all right? Radio is down here. Okay, optical is up here. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, Jansky is living in a world dominated by optical astronomers. Okay, and if you look at the spectrum of a star, it looks something like that. What was Jansky's sensitivity? Something like this. Okay, so this is kind of where he was. So they were drawing this picture saying, you're ridiculous, what are you doing? Why would you do this? There will be nothing to see. We know the universe is about stars, there's nothing to see. And what did he see? A whole bunch of stuff. The universe was filled with stuff that doesn't have this spectrum, but has spectra that look like this. And we call that stuff non-thermal, because it's not black body. Okay, it's not just hot glowing things. It's something different. And it turns out it's energetic electrons zipping around magnetic fields. The universe is filled with this stuff. Right? And the only reason why we know about it because Jansky didn't succumb and decide to work on optical astronomy. All right. So any other messenger. So I listed a couple. Gravitational waves, we know what we expect to see. Undoubtedly, if it's not just much more fantastic, I'll be disappointed. High-energy gamma rays, again, we're opening up a new universe. Low-energy radio, low-frequency radio, something that, you know, above the ionospheric cutoff is something that's unexplored, and maybe neutrinos. But, you know, 100 years is a long time.
Thank you, Avery.